Welcome to Zero Downtime, the new podcast brought to you by DCD's editorial team in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical infrastructure provider.
Vertiv has kept the world's leading businesses connected for more than 50 years. We build, deliver, and support critical infrastructure that's available, sustainable, and future-ready. Visit us at Vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Welcome to the Zero Downtime podcast. Now, we've been doing these for going on for 2 years. So it's quite often that we find we need to revisit subjects. Now, last year we spoke to Tony Grayson. He's at Compass Data Centers and he's a former nuclear submariner and pretty much the best expert we know about how data centers might use nuclear power in future. Now, with this conversation was first broadcast as a fireside chat as part of our DCD online events program. We hope you enjoy it here on the podcast. Thanks for joining us. Welcome aboard, Tony.
No, thank you, Peter, and thanks for having me.
Okay, so I mean, a few months ago, maybe last year, people were talking about nuclear power as like a silver bullet that would magically solve the problem of providing enough energy, enough low carbon energy to get data centers to power all the data centers that we needed. Perhaps the reality isn't so straightforward. Where are you at the moment on the nuclear power question?
Yeah, I think I've been on a journey the past couple of years. You know, about a year and a half ago, I was, you know, starting to talk to these up and coming SMR, the small modular reactor companies. I'm learning more about them. Super excited, look for the timelines. And I think, you know, maybe a year and a half down the road, I'm a little more realistic on, you know, what I think the timelines are actually going to be and kind of what I think the costs are actually going to be. And so they're nothing like I thought it was a year and a half ago. You know, it's going to be much longer to build them than we thought it's going to. And I'm talking SMRs, not necessarily microreactors. I think they're going to be pretty good in the short term, but it's also going to be the levelized cost of energy is going to be a lot higher than we had thought. And it's just because we're, you know, a lot of the stuff we're comparing right now is subsidized. They're subsidized reactors doing tests for the government. And those are the numbers that we see. So I think we need to have a healthy dose of skepticism, not that they won't happen, just in the timeline that we want them. You know, that's in our world we want. You know, if you build something in the next 36 months, no cloud provider is going to care about you. And that's not what's going to, you're going to get a reactor in 36 months. And 36 months might even be too long.
Okay. And absolutely. And it's probably worth mentioning, as I didn't say it at the start, that you talked about your journey with nuclear reactors. It goes back a lot further than that. And there's a reason why we come to you when we want to talk about nuclear.
Now, I mean, I think there's definitely a lot of smart people out there who are talking to nuclear. There are companies that are really starting to invest in hiring people who have run plants before. You know, my background is, you know, 21 years in the submarine force in the U.S. Submarines are all nuclear. And so I've qualified on, I guess, four reactors. One reactor I was actually certified to run it by Department of Energy Naval Reactors. To run it myself. And that was just when you command a submarine, you have to go through that. So definitely a lot of background and different designs of plants. And I, you know, and through the, you know, after that, I've kept in touch with a lot of the commercial technology stuff through friends. Cause I mean, that's the biggest feeder of the nuclear commercial reactors is now is people like me who have come out of the nuclear, you know, the nuclear Navy, and it doesn't have to be US, it could be UK, it could be French. It doesn't have to be the US nuclear Navy, but the nuclear navies in total feed a lot of the commercial plants around the world.
Right. Yeah. You've got a lot of experience sitting up right up close to nuclear reactors and making them work safely. So that's, yeah it's a plus. And so it means you're actually comfortable around nuclear reactors. So you'd be happy to have data centers powered by them. So if you're starting to make a realistic projection about it, we should be listening to that.
No, and I'm definitely super sold on nuclear. I think it is a very good way to provide baseload power. And I think that the way the designs are evolving, you know, we're on the kind of generation 3+ now, when the 3+ adds these passive systems of cooling in, which, you know, are not have to have a human operator intervention. And as we move on to the Gen 4, which are really these fast neutron reactors or stuff like TerraPower that are looking for different kinds of coolant, I think they're becoming even safer. And so I think it's a very good use, you know, it's a very good base load power. And despite what people think, I don't, you know, especially these fast neutron reactors, they don't generate that much waste comparably to what they give. And they will drive energy down. I mean, it's, we talk the digital divide a lot, you know, about how we get broadband out to people, how we get computers out to people. But before the digital divide, you need energy, you need cheap energy. Without cheap energy, there's no point bringing broadband to people because they can't use it. And so that's why I think, you know, you got to start at the basic, at, you know, the basic aspects of it, which is that, you know, how do you get cheap energy to these places?
Mm-hmm. Yep, cheap and low carbon energy.
Yeah, so cheap and low carbon. Yeah. No, very definitely cheap and low carbon.
Yeah. And so, yeah, let's talk in a little more detail about the generations of nuclear power, because, I mean, we've had huge, long, risky projects which have kind of put a lot of people off nuclear. You know, the sort of giant projects which take forever to do, and they've maybe got a stigma because one or two of them have had accidents and that sort of thing. But that pitch is changing.
No, I would say, you know, kind of going back to the designs, we're going back to the 50s with the Generation 1 plants. These were just the basic test plants that were out there as nuclear power was coming in. And in this time also, we had the first nuclear submarine, which was USS mm-hmm. Nautilus in 1955. But then you kind of moved on into, you know, the Generation 1 kind of lasted from 1950 to roughly 2010. Then we shifted to the Generation 2, which are these large-scale power stations. And a majority of the plants you see around the world are Generation 1, Generation 2 plants. And this is where we had problems, because they definitely could never be completed on time. And they definitely could not be completed on budget. And I think a lot of this has to do with is they were not standardized. And so if you have a Westinghouse pressurized water reactor that's a four loop system, you go from one campus to another, it's different. So if you ever wonder why any of these people have to be qualified like as nuclear reactor operators at each plant, it's because each plant is different. So when you introduce that kind of level of, you know, kind of difference between plants, you know, you're always going to find something new. There's no lessons learned transferred. So, I mean, I really do think that's really been the Achilles heel is on nuclear is the inability to finish on time. I mean, we're talking not finish on time. We're like talking 25 years down the road and you still haven't finished the darn thing. And you're at plus a gazillion dollars than you originally thought. So it's not like I'm just a year late, you know, $1 million. We're talking massive delays. And there's plenty of reasons why that happened. But, you know, I think it all stems from just the plants were all very, very different, which makes different regulations, which makes different things you have to test, which makes, you know, all these regulatory agencies get involved on it. But the newest generations, which is really the Gen 3, Gen 4, which is starting in 1990s. And I guess, let me go back. I just want to, actually, Peter, can I start one more thing back, going back? You know, the Generation 1 was like 1950. Generation 2 was like around 1970. I'm getting myself confused on the Generation 3. Generation 3 was around 2008, 2009. And then, the Generation 4 is starting just now. But, you know, the first primary, like we had talked about, of first Gen 1, Gen 2, but we're starting to hear more about this Gen 3 and Gen 3 Plus, which I mentioned are the passive systems. So hopefully that wasn't too confusing.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, and the point you mentioned about the lack of standardization is the point where we're at the moment, which is kind of
The SMRs, small modular reactors, that's the in essence, that is that's probably the most significant difference with them.
I mean, I think that the significant difference on the SMRs really it's the manufacturing the manufacturing capability of the reactor vessels, where first of all, kind of define it, micro reactors are less than 20 megawatts electrical, the small reactors are 20 to 300, the medium are 300 to 700, and the large reactors, which are majority of the world, are over 700 megawatts electrical. So we're talking about the 20 megawatts to 300 megawatts, and what they've done is try to shift that the kind of the reactor vessel to outside, kind of to a manufacturing process, no different than the data center community has gone to more of a manufacturing approach than a stick build approach. But the curious thing I'm still waiting to see is you still have a lot of stuff that has to be constructed on site. You got the whole plant building. You have the whole steam plant building. You have the whole electrical generation building. So the question I had really is manufacturing a reactor vessel in an offsite enough to offset these time delays, or cost delays that we've seen inside the community. Now, the other thing it has for it is they're trying to standardize on the design for it too. So they've built on the lessons learned of those, kind of generation two plants. So it's going to be interesting to see. But really the problem is we don't have an SMR up and running yet. Probably the closest one is NuScale. And NuScale, I mean, despite what everyone thinks, they're moving quick. They started this thing in 2008. And, to get, they were just approved in, I think it was 2020, they had their design approved. But if you look at from that time in 2008 to 2020, when it was approved, they submitted, I think they submitted like 2 million pages of documentation, their regulatory committee, and they spent $500 million to get it from 2008 to 2020. So this is not something that's been just new out there. This is, no one's really been talking about how much this stuff's been happening.
Right. And that's a really good point to remember when talking to any other proposed nuclear reactor vendor system. If they haven't mentioned that part of it, the effort of getting approval, then there's a big that's a big gap in their business plan that they haven't told you about.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the way the businesses and technology system work is, there people take pride that we're building a business while it's taken off. It's the airplane. That doesn't work for nuclear. The saying of crap in equals crap out. That's definitely a different word, is kind of what you get when you submit a crappy design, a poor design, and you're trying to run it through any kind of regulatory agencies. And I'm not trying to say any of these people are submitting bad designs, but I'm not sure a lot of them are completely sussed out. And so you have lots and lots of changes, and which makes this whole approval process take so long.
Right. I mean, so the idea that let's make it all a standard design, let's manufacture as much of it in factories as we possibly can. Sounds great, but it may be a little bit idealistic, and we may end up with problems in it as we did before.
No, I definitely think we're going to have some growing pains at the beginning, but I think we'll learn our lessons and get it. But we're still talking, if you look at NuScale, still the closest, and that's already slipped, and it's 2029. I think it's going to be hard pressed to get to 2029. I think we're talking 2032, 2033, just based on kind of the gut feeling on other slippages. Now, if you look at, they started in 2008, and we're looking at 2032, 2033. We're looking at another 10 years. Now imagine any other plant that's trying to start like Rolls-Royce or some of these other plants So I do think it's going to be very hard for, SMRs to get over this kind of hurdle. I mean, that's why if you look at a lot of what people are taking for SMRs isn't truly an SMR. It just fits in that it's more of a small reactor, which fits in that, which is the GE Westinghouse one, or the GE Hitachi one, sorry. And they're using that one because it's an established plant that they built before. They just had passive cooling systems onto it. So when you look at some of these people who are taking it's small reactors, they're not modular reactors, it's these GE Hitachi plants because they've been built before. So they kind of know what you're getting. You it's already been approved and you kind of can guess what the timeline is.
Yeah, that sounds good. I mean, as a putting a positive on it, it's as if instead of spending a lot of time building and rebuilding and changing the design while you're actually making the reactor, the nowadays people are getting through a bit more of that in the process, in the application stage, when they're trying to, before they actually start making the thing. So there's less hours and amounts of material wasted in the process.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I, you know, if you look at what's happened in the other community, which is the microreactor community, they've actually had fully sussed out designs that they're getting approved. And I really do think, you know, in the near term, you are going to see microreactors out before you're going to see small modular reactors. And microreactors are, you know, anything than 20 megawatts electrical, which could be down as low as 10. But I think they're super interesting right now because they are a self-enclosed system. So I, you know, think of it like a nuclear battery, if you will, that you plug in, you power it. Once it hits its end of life, when your battery dies, you take that off, the company replaces it with another one. So it is definitely more simplistic. You take out all the construction stuff that's always been a problem. You truly optimize the manufacturing because a lot of it is manufactured and delivered. And they're definitely going to be at the shorter time frame. And you can read at, there's some really good ones that are happening right now. That it's you know, Project Pele in Idaho, in the United States. They have three designs. All, and this is all based on U.S. Army, but they have three designs and they're pretty far along on their process on the microreactor. So I do think, you know, it's, I know we're getting bigger and bigger in the data center community. You know, we're pushing this because of AI, like these 400 or 500 megawatt campuses, but the microreactors are really good ideas for, you know, the smaller campuses. Think less than 100 megawatts, and it could be backup power. It could be just surge power, maybe to offload. It doesn't have to be necessarily complete baseload power. And I do think we need to be looking, SMRs are great and I like them and I love the idea, but let's figure out how to make, you know, the microreactors work in our systems right now, I think is, which will be more short-term.
Right. I mean, how physically, what's the physical size of a microreactor?
A Connex box. It arrives on a Connex. I mean, it's a really, they're trying to keep it the size of a Connex box. So 40 by 8 by 8, they're trying to keep it at that size. And, you know, it's all enclosed. It requires minimal manning. It's just a totally different setup than what you have with, you know, pump driven or thermal driven, you know, water cooled thing. It's just a very different design. I mean, it's, you know, look what we put on spacecraft. Those are essentially nuclear batteries that we put up there. And these are, I mean, satellites and everything. It's just, you know, different versions of that technology.
Right. Because, I mean, reactors for space tend to have been kind of like thorium and thermal, don't they?
Yeah, man, there are some that are actually doing that, those kind of thorium and thermal designs. You're just getting different, and there's plenty of different ways to approach the, you know, kind of BWXTs, taking a different way than Xcel and all this other stuff of how they're doing it. But they're all interesting, unique designs that are meant to be kind of, you know, control itself with not a lot of oversight on it. And you know, they can do it just because of the design and the amount of megawatts, which is significantly less than, let's say, a 300 megawatt plant. It's just it's an order of several orders of magnitude different.
Right. Yes. I mean, and it's quite a sign of the times that we're talking about a 20 megawatt nuclear power plant and saying, well, that's not really big enough for the data centers we're
thinking. No, it is. It is. And I think AI just, you know, probably kicked over the table and then completely redefined on what we think is a normal size campus and what we're thinking of not. But if you think about it, you know, a lot of the AI stuff we're talking is really the LLM stuff. And yes, we're going to have these 500 megawatt campuses, but what's inference AI going to need? I doubt it's going to be 500 megawatts. Maybe it's more around the 5 to 10 megawatts of AI in a certain area, which is right in a microreactor's wheelhouse.
Right. I mean, the drawback there, I guess, is that those inference sites are going to have to be quite close to people who might.
No, they will have to be close to people. And some people get nervous about nuclear, but I think it's, you know, I think it's a couple of interesting things, the way to think about it. First is, you know, if you look at the United States, you know, I live in Seattle, definitely not the biggest love of nuclear, but they actually have 15, 16, essentially small reactors within 10 miles that they never think about. You know, Portsmouth in UK is another one where you have your, you know, submarines, and I forgot how many submarines are out there, but those are all nuclear. No one really thinks about the small reactors that are, they're there because, you know, the navies tend to run them really well. And, you know, we, our Navy and, you know, the UK's Navy, or really no Navy has really had that many, like, you know, in you know, French among those kind of ones that share the designs have had any problems since they've started going, it's just the mid 50s. And so I think, you know, the SMRs have taken a step in the right direction with this passive cooling. It used to be on these other larger reactors, you had actually had to plan around like a 10 mile, and I'm using US based numbers because that's what I know better. You had to plan around 10 miles around your site. And so you had to get all these different cities and counties aligned with you for this 10 mile radius around your site. Now, a site is roughly 13, 14 acres, and that's all the planning you have to do. Your planning stops at your fence line. So your order of preparation, your order of things that you have to do is significantly different, significantly less, because you're just controlling things inside your fence line now. And I do think it's interesting to see now, that's with SMRs, what happens when you get to the micro reactors. And I don't think, at least that I know of, that's been decided of where the nuclear planning stops at.
Right. That's going to be fairly crucial.
Yep, it's exactly. But if you think about it, you know, that's, you know, do the math on it, on the area of 10 miles, you know, 10 miles an hour area, and now it's just 14 acres. It is, I mean, if you ever look at the changes in regulations, that is significant difference on how you align and how you have to plan for your nuclear areas and how you plan for your, you know, disaster areas on that kind of stuff. But I do think it's another thing that you brought up earlier, which I think is also important to talk about, just to get it out there. Yes, there's been three significant problems that are out there in terms of what reactors, whichever one is like the site, which is Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima. But if you, I mean, if you look at it, Fukushima is super interesting to me just because they made a design decision to save $1 million to put the diesels right next to the seawall. Saved $1 million. What's the first thing that happened when this tsunami hit? They lost all their backup power because their vessels right by the seawall. Also, there are more than one plant there. Some of those plants did shut down. The last plants that didn't shut down, they couldn't get permission for. And then there was a decision made that they could have flooded it with seawater and stopped the whole thing. But the decision, they didn't want to ruin the plant by flooding it with seawater. And look what happened. So if you look at, you know, Fukushima, I would look at design and operator, kind of what happened. Chernobyl was a graphite powered plant, or graphite moderated plant, which means as power increases, the rate of power increases, as opposed to water, which is as power increases, the rate of power decreases. So it's inherently kind of, it's a stabler plant, but they disabled all their, you know, safety measures. They took it, they operated like, reactors are designed to operate 0 and 100%. It's not like a naval reactor, which is on design to operate anything in between. They moved it at 70% and they disabled safeties and they ran a test. So also design, it was operating out of design. And, you know, Three Mile Island, yes, some reactivity did escape, but it wasn't nowhere near as bad as everyone makes it out to be. Just because, you know, no one really understands what, you know, radiation, and this is where the nuclear committee really sucks, is they need to get in front of people and talk to them. I think TerraPower did it great, where they had open hall, you know, town hall meetings. They went to Wyoming, in the United States. They asked, had people ask questions, and they dispelled the fear. So the nuclear community has been totally just, you know, don't ask me any questions, I don't want to talk about it. But I think if they did talk about it, people would understand, you know, kind of, to alleviate a lot of their concerns, especially with radiation, about how safe these plants actually really are. Hopefully, they all make sense.
Yeah. I mean, I've been looking at the actual deaths caused by any of those accidents. Minimal.
It's absolutely minimal compared to coal and everything else. And I think it's, But
Yeah,
no one, no one puts.
that's an even better comparison, isn't it? Compared to coal, you consider the deaths caused by burning fossil fuels,
Yeah, I
even
think
before
it's.
you take in global warming. The
There's a great graph out there. If you look at deaths per terawatt hour, it shows coal like at 100 deaths per terawatt hour, and nuclear is at the very end of 0.04, and that's less than hydro, which is 0.1. Wind is even 0.15. So
Yeah.
it's it, there is really not a lot of deaths compared to that stuff. And I think, well, you're hiding behind stuff. Radiation is long-lived, maybe it's not associated, but we're around radiation every day. Like you fly in a plane, you get 2 millirem per every 1,000 miles. Sleeping next to someone at night, you get like 20, I think it's 20 millirem per month. An X-ray is 250 millirem. Me sleeping next to a reactor, I got like 6 millirem per 3 months. So like reactors are actually really safe in terms of how much radiation they put out. And we're around radiation all the day, all the time. And you get a lot of radiation through just natural occurring radiation, whether it's radon or even through, X-rays or MRIs and that kind of stuff, which is significantly more significant than you ever get living next to a planet. I mean, and in a sense,
You really are
it,
positive about
no,
reactors.
it,
You'd rather
it,
date a nuclear reactor than a person.
no, I just think it's a great discussion and a great conversation to have. And yes, I am totally biased and I realize that because I've been operating for 21 years, but these are the conversations that no one has, that we should be having. And we should really be talking about how much radiation's around you, how much radiation compared to a reactor, where I'm super definitely bias on the positives, but I'm just somewhat more negative now on the timeline for everyone to deliver some of this stuff
Things,
at.
yeah, the things become more realistic. There's another realism point I was thinking. The micro reactors are going to be very good in terms of providing a chunk of power that you need in one go. How
Yeah.
quickly could the industry ramp up, and how many of these can they produce when they
I
get
think
going? Is it?
that's a great question. I don't know if they know that yet. I think right now they need to get the design approved and then work out their manufacturing process. But ideally, they probably want to start at 1 a month and then increase from there. But that's only 10 megawatt or 20 megawatt electrical. It's, they're going to have to figure out more of the manufacturing process to be able to do more of these, which I hope they kind of figure out soon. But that's a great question. I just don't know.
So I mean, I'm thinking that the data center sector has reached a size where you have to consider its demands in the context of the demands of the whole of society. And I'm sort of thinking, if the micro reactor industry can produce, I don't know, 100 megawatts of power per year, or ramping up to gigawatts per year. Should the data center industry even be taking that instead of leaving it to the other to decarbonize other parts of the
I mean,
world?
I think if you want a reactor before the end of 2030, it's going to have to be a micro reactor. And I'm sure people out there argue with me on this one. I just don't see it happening. I think it's going to be a micro reactor if you want it before 2030, because a lot of these plants right now, I think they will take orders right now because they're going through the whole regulation process. So, they'll take orders right now and build it for you. And I mean, and SMRs will do the same thing, but it's really GE Hitachi, that's it. Anything else you're waiting on, they still got to build it and they got to test the design, where GE Hitachi has kind of already tested that design.
And will data centers be like a significant part of the market for these when they first appear? Will data centers be doing the role of like seeding the thing and getting it going?
I mean, I really do think we can sign a lot of PPAs. I think it's, I was at an event where it was reactor designers and it was power companies. And it was like the whole conversation is, I mean, I hate to say it like this, just because it's in our industry. It's like, well, how do we get $1 billion? Because a lot of these SMRs were designed to keep it under $1 billion. And I'm like, well, that's really nothing for a data center where, sign a 40-year PPA. It's something. But I think the only way it's going to have to work is you know, they build baseload, they build a baseload power for a certain area, and we as the data center community take a part of that. I don't think, and I could be wrong about this, it's too far out to be a field of dreams. Like, if you build it, they will come, because we have no clue, zero clue what's going to happen in the next 13, 14 years in the data center community. I mean, if we could have flying data centers for all we know, you know, and it's just, it's satellite, we could be getting away with cable landing stations because of satellite and laser to laser comms, and we just have no clue what the future is. So I don't think this is going to be a build it and they will come. This is more about build it for base load, serve the community, and have the data center sign a PPA to help fund that data center coming down, at least in my opinion. You know, there's definitely other people who think otherwise out there.
So yeah, it's kind of at a stage where a lot of data center PPAs could help the industry get started in its early stages.
Exactly. And then there's also the other problem, you know, too, which is you got to build the nuclear, but how do you get the power? Like, one big problem we have is it's not necessarily baseload power per se. It's how do you transmit the baseload power to the user? Because no one wants a power transmission line in their backyard. It ruins their sight lines, whatever. They all want the cheap power, but they don't want how you actually get it off the baseload to the actual location. At least here in the States, I mean, Ashburn, Virginia is a great example of, you know, they have the baseload and they just can't get it there because they haven't built the transmission lines, or they tried to, if the community stopped them.
Yes, absolutely true. And, you know, globally, because we're decarbonizing and moving so many things onto electricity, we need so many more pylons and distribution networks, and to replace the ones that are already there. I saw a report that said we've more or less in the next 10, 15 years got to build the equivalent of today's entire power distribution networks.
Yeah, that's the problem I think we're not talking about. We're definitely talking the baseload problem, but this other little thing, the transmission, I don't really think we're talking about it that much. Now, I could be completely wrong, but I've yet to see any article talking. I mean, a lot of articles talking about, you know, kind of, we need to get up there and fix the transmission line problem. It needs to happen at the same time as we're fixing the baseload and power problem, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of issues going on where it's not entirely clear the extent to which big users like data centers are paying for, they're paying for the power, they're paying to have their substations and things, but then are they paying all the upstream distribution?
No, I think I know how some of them are doing it, but a lot of it, yes, it stops at the substation, whether they're subsidizing a substation or building their own substations. You still got to get that power from A to B.
Yeah.
You can build as many substations as you want if you can't fix the upstream problem. And it all comes down to it's the permitting. It's no different than data centers. It's, you know, how do you get the right of ways to build your transmission lines when everyone, you know, is already thinking about, you know, they don't want data centers near them, or they don't want power stations near them. They sure as heck don't want, you know, they don't want wind generation. They don't want any of this stuff. And in effect, their sight lines of near their home. And then there's a fear too of electromagnetic radiation that they get off the power lines. If it's not nuclear, it's that. It's, you know, so it's, you can't have it both. You can't have it all these different ways. You know, it's, we are going to have to get up on some things to be able to really lower the site of power and the cost of power.
Yeah, that sounds very true. Maybe that's a pitch for having more micro reactors, because if a micro reactor sitting next to a 10 megawatt load involves no distribution lines and it's more self-sufficient.
No, and to be honest, if you look at my kind of rambling for the last year and a half on this stuff, it really was, I hate to say it, I was kind of poo-pooing the micro reactors, saying, you know, SMRs are the near-term future. Mm-hmm. And I think I was making bets that we'll have an SMR, you know, in the next 5 or 6 years. But I've kind of, you know, as I probably should have done more research and talked to more people before I kind of made those kind of statements. But I really do think the micro reactors could be definitely a shorter term. And it could be a better point source. What I just don't know is, you know, I know kind of the regulations that are surrounding the small modular reactors or the small reactors less than 300 megawatt electrical. I don't know what the regulations are going to be for that micro reactors in terms of what, you know, kind of the government or industry is going to put on where they can go. What do they need to do? You know, is it just like a 200 meter standoff? I don't know on any of this stuff. And that's what I'd be super curious to learn is kind of what that is. And I think you're right. If we solve that and it's not overly restrictive, that could be an easy way to solve a lot of these these point source power problems where dropping these micro reactors to provide that power.
Right. Talk us through briefly the passive protection systems for cooling. I mean, because why are they better? Are there any loopholes and drawbacks to them?
Yeah, I mean, there's the passive systems is basically you have a way to relieve the power, like you can lower power by, you know, a passive system, whether it's a thermal driving head, like there are some plants right now you could actually walk away from and it will cool itself for the next 3 or 4 weeks without any human intervention. And it's just, you know, the wonderful laws of thermodynamics, you know, thermal driving head, which, you know, hot water rises, it cools itself, it comes back down. Hot water rises, it cools itself, it comes back down. But the problem is when you do something like that, and I think this is what the industry is going to start having to struggle with, and I think they are struggling with, is they're just not talking about it, is you have these passive systems, you probably got rid of all your active systems. Passive systems have a lot of variables on how well how good they're going to be, whether it's in a hot climate, a cold climate, and everything else. Active systems, you inject boron, you know exactly what's going to happen to the plant. You know, the thermal driving head or these passive systems is more ethereal. It's going to depend on the location. And we know with regulators do not like, they want exact data. They want exact experiments. So I think the passive systems are already having problems with, they can't provide exact data on the amount of cooling, and regulators are struggling with that too. But then I hate to say this, but what happens when someone takes over your control room in a plant? You have no way to shut down the reactor if your passive systems. On an active system, you can shut it down remotely. On a passive system, you can't. So how do you resolve that issue? I mean, I think these are stuff that I'm not sure if they, you know, at least I'm sure they're thinking about or looking at, but I definitely think it's stuff that, you know, it's kind of happening on the down low that they're trying to figure this stuff out. But I think there's actual real concerns about that kind of stuff. And they actually took off the active systems to really drive that price down too, because they're super expensive. So what do you do then? I mean, do you add it back in and raise your already high levelized cost of energy at even more, or do you try to make it work? I don't know. And I think that's something industry's gonna have to figure out. Smart people to me, they're gonna have to figure it out.
Right. And so for both, does that affect both micro reactors and small modules?
But I think it affects more of the small reactors than the micro reactors, because micro reactors are designed a little bit differently on it. They have some of those active safety measures as well as the passive safety measures, just because they're designed to be all encompassing in this Connex box kind of solution. But I do think it's, you know, what could be interesting are these, you know, kind of the most advanced reactors, these generation 4, these fast neutron reactors, which have a very different design on, you know, the way they basically use neutrons to use, you know, to create power and everything. And I think, you know, those are inherently safer, those fast neutron reactor designs are inherently safer just because of, you know, the density of the fuel and how far the neutron has to operate, and, you know, kind of the ability to provide safety systems on it. So I do think this generation 4, which a lot of these FNRs are inherently safer. It might just be the way to solve this passive versus active system cooling.
Move on. Yeah.
Yeah. And because, I mean, I think it's interesting to know on these generation 3, generation 4, when they're actually out of fuel, they still have about 95% fuel left. And that's what these generation 4 fast neutron reactors are designed to do, which is really use a larger quantity of that fuel. In fact, they can even use the fuel from these other generation three plus modules and these generation 4 modules. They're just in, like, great example is TerraPower. I mean, they to me, that makes the most sense, where, you know, it operates at normal operating pressure. You're 400 degrees away from boiling. So it's an inherently safer design than pressurizing something to, you know, 1500 or 2100 pounds to be able to cool it with water. So it's just, and maybe the future is just we wait for the generation four. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's smart people to me that are looking at this kind of stuff.
Right. So all these are factors that make the small modular reactor kind of the timeline to make them become impractical, sort of out there, really.
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to see these ones that are being built in like Wyoming and some of these test cases, but I think that's super cool, the test cases. I'm more interested in how are they going to expand that farther out there to these other locations? How are they going to be able to produce it in these other locations? That's the more interesting thing to me. How are they going to be able to commercialize it? Because I have no doubt you can build any test reactor you want in a specific location with specific rules overseen by some regulatory agency. But how do you build 50 of them or 60 of them? That's really where I think the rub is.
Right. And I mean, before we finish, we should probably talk a little bit about fusion, because in a lot of people's minds, it's the next thing. It's going to be just a few years after we sort out the SMRs. What's the reality on fusion at this stage?
You know, I think it's fusion. If you look at the results, it's one of these things that's super cool scientifically, you know, and fusion began with, you know, let's just go with the difference between fission and fusion. You need fission for fusion, and fission basically gets a neutron, goes against uranium-235, makes cesium-140, rubidium-92, spits off some neutrons, which complete the reaction, your train reaction, and it puts out like 200 microelectric volts. Fusion is you take deuterium and tritium, you push them together to make fusion, which switches out helium and neutron, and you make energy. That requires a lot of power. So what they've done recently with fusion, great scientifically, they only made like, I think it was like 0.5% of the power that was, you know, it was only made like 0.5% of the power that was actually put over it, meaning it didn't really generate that much power. And that was only heat. You still got to take said heat and convert it to electricity, which you're going to have all sorts of losses there. So I love it scientifically, all for it, engineering wise. Yes. I don't know how they're going to, you know, how are you going to do that? It's how do you design a system that can capitalize on that? So I do think we should not hold off advances in fission for fusion. Fusion will happen down the road, but it's right now it's just that more of a scientific experiment, in my opinion, than it is anything else. And I would hate to see the benefits of fission that can give us in the near term as we wait for fusion. Mm.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think it's kind of irresponsible of people that are claiming to be nuclear fusion startups selling PPAs to cloud providers.
Not going to say anything about that whatsoever. Not going to say anything. We should be focusing on fusion because that really is the future, and I get it, but you need fission for fusion. And if we barely have enough fission right now and power to help ourselves, let alone to help fusion in the future. I mean, it's definitely where things we should be working on, because it is a much cleaner source of power than it is than fission is.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's really exciting what's happening there. I mean, and that experiment where they, you know, if you zoom in close enough on the little bead of fusion fuel, in terms of right up close to it, in terms of the energy going in, they were getting more energy out than they were putting in. But then, as you say, the energy was going on in the form of a laser, which took many.
Oh, it's the amount of megajoules. Yes, exactly. But it's still, they proved it. You still got to take it from scientific to engineering wise. But I do think, you know, the fission really, I think the safe is the cool stuff, which is the generation four, which is their totally different designs, which use much better safety measures, which don't have this thing about if it gets too hot, it makes hydrogen, it makes things go boom. that we have with our previous generation plans that we have.
Yeah, that's a drawback.
Yeah, it is kind of a drawback, but it solves a lot of those problems and picks. It's just the problem is, you know, with the highly enriched uranium, which we can only get outside Russia, now the U.S. is trying to, you know, build it itself to get this 20% enriched uranium that it needs. It's just delaying everything. And so, you know, we're probably, probably mid-2030s, we'll start seeing, you know, the TerraPower's plant or some of these other Generation 4 plants deploy. But I really do think if you look at something that's safe, reliable in the future that we really should be a lot focused on, it's the Generation 4 plants. They're just going to take a little bit longer than you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the story. That's the way so many things go, isn't it? Yeah.
We're just moving so rapidly in the data center community. I mean, like if you're building something 3 years down the road, you're already too late right now. It just seems to be, you got to have the power and you got to have it now. So it's this interesting juxtaposition of, you know, how do you balance, how do you take a guess at what the future is going to be? And that's why I like the baseload more. Solve for baseload for communities or for the countries. And then, you know, have the data centers as an enabler of that to help fund the money. Cause I mean, it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Like I said, digital divide. I'm glad we're putting a bunch of broadband out. It starts with energy. Without energy, it's everything else is somewhat pointless.
Yeah. And I mean, the data centers have done a good job of helping to pull and commercialize in renewable energy sources, solar and wind, all the wind farms and solar farms that have been paid for through hyperscale data centers must do something to bring those prices down.
And maybe we do, you know, right now the levelized cost of energy is a lot higher than we originally thought. I think we wanted it at like $88. You know, subsidized, it's more around $100. Unsubsidized, it's like $150. So prices aren't going down as much as we thought, but maybe we give some relief to the local community on their dollars of, you know, maybe we absorb some of their, you know, their pennies they're paying on the, you know, per kilowatt hour. We take that on ourselves to help better the community around us, to make power cheaper for the local community and enable that to happen. I mean, I do think we need to be looking at interesting ways to do that on, you know, more than just we're coming in and providing jobs and taxes. Maybe we can actually help them get cheap power too. To help them out and help them grow too, and that local community.
All right. And actual nuclear powered data centers. I mean, are you aware of anyone that's getting close to that?
No, man. There's definitely a couple of ones that are built around it, like Cumulus up in Pennsylvania, Wyoming Hyperscale in Wyoming. And then there's been new stuff in Virginia about we're going to build it and hold campuses of nuclear. I mean, I think it's the time to market problem of, you know, how it's actually two things. There are two problems. I mean, it's a time to market problem of how quick it's going to take to build a reactor, provide that power for the data centers. And it's a network problem. You know, it's cheap power is not going to bring a data center. You need a network to be able to support a data center. And so you can't really go in some of these locations without having a really mesh network to support the data center. Look at Ashburn, the cable land station, great fiber connections north and south and east to west. You need to build around those stations. And unfortunately, a lot of the world, we haven't put a lot of money into fiber infrastructure. I mean, we're doing it now. Like the U.S. is spending roughly, it's the BEAD program is $44 billion. We spent $1 billion on middle mile, another $10 billion on broadband to rural areas. So we're spending the money now, and definitely EMEA is farther along than we are, but you need the fiber to build the data center, and cheap power should go along with it if possible. But and that's what I think is the difference is
if you're doing something today, you'd have to do it somewhere which is already quote zoned for nuclear and places
that's a given. It has to be zoned for nuclear just to go from a place that is not. But the funny thing is, a lot of these places,
those places tend to be remote for obvious reasons.
Exactly. But there are more places than you think that are zoned for nuclear. What basically happened was we're going to make a nuclear plant people just get frustrated after 10 years and build a coal plant because you can build that a lot quicker. So what I think is amazing is people don't know how many of these locations that are around them are actually zoned for nuclear. They just have another plant there just because people got so frustrated with waiting for the nuclear plant and regulations to kind of to be built there. So I think it's going to be interesting. I think people are going to be surprised when nuclear plants are coming up near them because they didn't know it was zoned nuclear.
So yes, nuclear plants might just appear when you least expect them.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. But I do think there's other technology that's happening out there we're just not talking about. And I think, you know, Rolls-Royce is probably the greatest example of that, where Rolls-Royce has an SMR and they're building an SMR, but they've actually taken their UK design, submarine design, and basically said, how big can we make this? And so they have a new design, which is actually like 700 megawatt design. It's by no means a micro reactor, but it is a new generation design, all based on their submarine reactor design, which is very, very good. And it's going to be a more manufactured approach of how they're delivering mm-hmm. that. But I do think we need to be looking at, we're zoomed in on the SMRs. We definitely need to look at the micro reactors, but we need to look at some of these other things that are these larger reactors that we're doing cool things on right now, like Rolls-Royce with the submarine reactor. And like I said, you know, UK, I'll just use UK and US as an example. In 1955, we have never had a problem with any submarine reactor at all. No release of radiation or anything of that kind of stuff. So I think that's pretty cool to me.
Yeah.
And that reactor will make sense to me because I, you know, some of these new ones they're beyond me, but that Rolls-Royce reactor, that one makes sense to me.
Yeah, and it's pushing the boundaries of small modular reactor, isn't it? That's a big small reactor.
No, it is a big, I mean, by technical definition, it's not a small reactor by megawatts, but it is built on the foundation of essentially a small reactor that is fit in a submarine. Now you just scaled it up to figure out how big you can build it. But the benefit of that is you've already done the design. It's something that's repeatable. So you're basically, every time you put in one of these, it's going to be exactly the same as opposed to what we've done in the past, like a Westinghouse, and changed the design every place you put it in.
Right. So there's lots of positive things happening, and there's some good engineering going on. And
now there's definitely a lot of positive things happening about it. And, you know, I think we just need to have a dose of realism on it. And will things change? I'm sure they'll change. As people, you know, money can solve a lot of things. And as they dump more money into it, maybe things will happen. But I do think it's going to be micro reactors in the near term, generation 3 plus around 2030. That's only a stopgap to where what we really want to generation 4, which is probably 2035 and beyond, is really what I think the future. But remember, like I said, some of these, the generation 1, generation 2, so 1960s, 1970s, are majority of the plants around the world right now. And so those are all reaching end of life. And so we're going to have to replace all those too.
Yeah. Excellent. Some great predictions there. I think we're going to have to meet up again in 6 months or a year and see what's changed and what's happened.
Yes, exactly. And I have made bets on this stuff before, and I have owed money on when I actually thought the first reactor would be out there. But hey, I actually, you know, by letter of the law, though, I think I won some of the bets, though, because when Cumulus combined their data center with a large reactor, I never said it had to be an SMR. I just said it would be a data center with a reactor. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, I think I won, but I don't think the intent when I made the bet was take an existing large reactor and adding a data center to it.
Brilliant. Well, that's great. So thank you for talking to me. It's been a lovely conversation, and I'm hoping to talk to you again in future as this develops. Thanks.
No, I absolutely. And I do think, like AI, AI is going to drive a lot of different needs. And I do think this whole inference microreactor thing that no one's really thinking about right now, they seem to be married together, in my opinion, because it is, it's this 1 to 10 megawatts for inference AI, which is right in the microreactor sweet spot. And it could be a way to really power the AI inference of the future and how we're going to do it.
Right. So AI needs nuclear. That's a point to end with. Thank you for joining.
I think AI needs nuclear, and I do think inference is a good way to solve these 1 to 10 megawatt, which is really inference locations, exactly.
Brilliant.
Sustainability is no longer a nice to have. It's a priority. Vertiv Power cooling and IT management solutions for critical infrastructure are designed to reduce the use of energy, water, and space. From innovative liquid cooling to dynamic grid services, we work hand-in-hand with customers to enable them to meet their data center sustainability goals. Visit us at Vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Thanks for listening to the Zero Downtime Podcast, brought to you in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical digital infrastructure provider. Don't forget to like this podcast and subscribe to our channel. We'll see you again next time.